And good morning and welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley, and joining us now is award-winning writer and epidemiologist, Dan Werb. Now, Dan's latest book is titled Our Wild Familiars, How Animals Are Adapting to Cities and Reshaping the Natural World. Dan, thank you so much for being part of This Green Earth today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, so I would love to kick things off here by learning more about you and your background. So how did you get involved in first epidemiology, and how does that dovetail into your work in writing books like Our Wild Familiars?
Well, it is a long and circuitous journey, probably best told over a stiff drink, but I actually started out as a freelance journalist and I worked in publishing. And then I, through a series of events, got a job as a communications support person in an NGO that was working on issues around the war on drugs and drug trafficking internationally. And, you know, as part of that work, I just became exposed to this whole, what felt like to me, like a shadow history of the world that could be told through the movement of illegal drugs. And so I was really drawn to what felt like to me really interesting and largely misunderstood narratives. So I did lots of research. I got more, you know, interested in that as a journalist, and then eventually, you know, went back to school and did my training as an epidemiologist so I could really drill down into the dynamics of epidemics that were being experienced by people who were criminalized, who were marginalized. So, you know, that is my journey into epidemiology. But as I said, throughout it, it was really driven by a desire to understand what felt like to me these hidden narratives. And so, you know, as I got more and more established in the field and felt like I understood things a little bit better, I started writing about it as a science writer, as someone who could kind of translate that dense and often difficult to access scientific knowledge into stories that people understood. So it's funny how books have come to you. You know, at the end of that, of my last book, The Invisible Siege, one of the things that I was looking at was the origins of coronavirus spillover events. Mm-hmm. And I came across this word, synanthrope, which refers to animals that have found ecological niches in human environments, so cities and towns, and they're responsible for the increased risk of viral spillover events that we're experiencing, you know, basically all over the world now. Separate from the virology, though, I just love this word. Like, I'm a writer, and, you know, sometimes it's just enough to have a word, and that kind of sparks the imagination. And so after I, you know, even after I finished that book, this word synanthrope stayed with me, and it kind of unlocked this hidden universe of creatures, right? Like, I had never thought of urban animals as a class of their own. But after just understanding that, you know, scientifically they were understood like that, that ecologists classified these creatures around us as synanthropes with a particular set of challenges and adaptations, you know, I just ran with that. And yeah, and the result is Our Wild Familiars.
Yeah, and so this definition of synanthropes or examples of them would be like urban bats or rats. And then you give also examples that are really interesting, such as an octopus that is occupying space in these polluted waters of Seattle. So when we use the word synanthrope and we think of it, generally I think we probably default to coyotes and raccoons or animals that are more familiar to us, or animals we would describe as highly social. But you're also bringing in these other animals that we wouldn't describe in that way, but are coexisting with us in these urban spaces. So can you talk a little bit about the life of that octopus and what it might inform us about the future of animals such as this and how they're trying to adapt to our human changing environments?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, writing this book was super fun because it required a lot of field research. And so every chapter is in a different city and covers a different animal. So readers kind of get a tour of North America and parts of you know, the world abroad. And every single city that we land in, you know, we see it from the point of view of a different animal. In the case of the octopus, I mean, when I started writing this book, I did not think that I would be scuba diving amidst a bunch of garbage and trash on the seafloor of Seattle and coming face to face with a giant Pacific octopus, which is one of the most intelligent creatures on Earth, one of the most alien creatures on Earth. You know, they can grow to 30 feet long, tentacle to tentacle. They have 9 brains, one in each tentacle. They, you know, obviously lots of people know they can change the color and texture of their skin, but they do so despite only seeing in grayscale. So like they are this truly wondrous creature. And Seattle's this really interesting place, right? Because it's almost entirely surrounded by water. And it's also the site of about 16 Superfund sites. Mm-hmm. So these are places that are so toxic that the federal government has had to intervene and pour millions, sometimes tens of millions of dollars into cleanup. And so, you know, there's been munitions factories there that have leached arsenic and lead and other heavy metals into the water. There's been leakage from nuclear power plants that has leaked into the ocean. You know, these are very toxic and hostile marine environments. And, you know, we're talking about the environments right at the shore of Seattle. Mm. What's more, when I got there, I discovered that it's not just the chemicals, but there has just been these decades and decades of people and companies throwing trash into the water. So you dive down, there's rusted I-beams that are 90 feet long. There's, you know, I saw a Volkswagen van. There's refrigerators. There's pieces of the Tacoma Bridge that have fallen down. Yeah. Eliza Heery, who is the marine ecologist that made this discovery about octopus there, who's truly brilliant, you know, she's seen handguns and cell phones and came face to face with an octopus that was occupying an old boat that had crumbled into almost nothing that was full of golf balls. So the octopus had basically a golf ball enthusiast and had been collecting golf balls. And the thing about it is that on the one hand, these are truly apocalyptic environments.
Yeah.
Insofar as they've been so totally destroyed by pollution that they're, you know, they appear to be completely hostile to any forms of life living there. But what's incredible is that even in places that seem to have hit rock bottom environmentally, there are these signs of life. And in the case of Seattle and its seafloor, it's almost like we've been trying to, you know, destroy it as much as possible. Mm. And yet these incredibly elegant and mysterious, enigmatic creatures have not only found a way to survive in these places, but they actually, it turns out, prefer these areas close to Seattle, like right on the edges of Seattle, that are full of garbage, to areas out, you know, further away in the pristine ocean. And so the reasons for that are that octopus require topography. Like they need landscape features to make dens, to hide from other predators like seals and sea lions. And they, you know, they can't build their own. And so as soon as a refrigerator or a big piece of concrete or a VW van hits the ocean floor, it becomes part of the landscape. And that can actually be useful for octopus. And so scaling back here, you can look at this in a few different ways. I am a perennial optimist, and, you know, Eliza Heery, who, as I mentioned, you know, is the one who did this work, you know, I think she is too, to a certain extent. And so we can bemoan the fact that, you know, our cities are our centers of climate destruction, or we can look at this and say, oh my God, like, despite what seem to be our best efforts at just totally destroying landscapes, animals, plants are still going to find a way to survive and adapt to these environments and actually create burgeoning ecosystems. And that in and of itself is beautiful. But I think what it also says to us is, you know, let's take the lead here and start seeing cities as legitimate ecosystems in and of themselves, like, albeit totally bizarre ones. But we can start seeing cities as sites worthy of conservation and worthy of our efforts at creating more harmonious futures with nature.
And on that topic, in your book, you are citing that cities are nature and that they have a richness in biodiversity. And so if you're defining it as such, how do we start treating them or an alleyway or a city park as these vital ecosystems? How do we maintain that mentality, but also lean into our stewardship or responsibility as far as what is happening in our natural world?
Yeah. I mean, look, for a long time, cities were derided as biological deserts. So they were believed to be places where they're like nature just didn't happen. Over the past, I'd say 2 to 3 decades, the field of urban ecology has emerged in a meaningful way and has totally flipped the script on that. Like, cities are not biological deserts. They are replete with life. And some studies suggest that cities are potentially more biodiverse than the areas that surround them on balance, because they are placed and founded in the most biodiverse and fertile areas in a natural ecosystem, because we're like any other animal. We want to be where there's the greatest richness and resources. On top of that, we are currently in this period that some biologists are calling the Great Urban Shift in North America, where there are literally thousands of species that are moving into urban areas as a result of climate change, habitat, you know, urban sprawl, some habitat destruction, and, you know, sometimes just being pulled into cities by the fact that cities are also where some of their prey species are currently living. And so not only are cities biodiverse, but they're becoming more biodiverse at a really rapid clip. Mm-hmm. You know, in terms of how we can foster that, I think it starts with just recognizing that this is what's happening, that humans are definitely not alone, that cities are where animals are flocking. And so we have a certain responsibility to find ways to protect them. I mean, I think that's wonderful. I think a lot of people feel like they're disconnected from nature when they live in cities, and most people live in cities. But here is this incredible opportunity for us to become closer and feel more of a connection with the natural world. And we don't have to leave to do that. Like, we can do that in our day-to-day lives. So how do we do that, right? There are so many different, you know, small to big ways that we can redefine urban spaces and design our cities to foster, you know, foster biodiversity and protect the animals that live here. So, you know, it ranges from the huge projects like wildlife corridors. And so I'll give you one example. You might remember P22, which was a celebrity mountain lion that sort of emerged in LA during the pandemic. The entire world was stuck at home. And then P22, this mountain lion, was being tracked, moving in and out of Griffith Park, became like a celebrity, honestly. There were viral stories about P22 from across the world. And P22 became this emblem of just how wild our urban spaces are. After the pandemic, P22 died. He was hit by a car. He was found in the backyard of a neighborhood in LA near Griffith Park. And he had created such an emotional response that LA, which had been trying to fund a wildlife corridor over the US 101 freeway, but couldn't get it funded for, you know, 10 years, suddenly all these groups came together and raised like $90 million. To fund this wildlife corridor. And this is going to be the largest wildlife corridor in the world. It's opening this year. It's going to be an acre wide and about 12 acres deep, you know, on both sides. And it's effectively going to be able to allow a pride of mountain lions that have been trapped in Santa Monica because they can't cross this freeway, which is just like a wall of hurtling metal, and have unfortunately been, you know, looking like they were going to go extinct because they don't have sufficient genetic diversity to maintain themselves. They're going to be able to cross this wildlife corridor and reproduce with, you know, group prides of mountain lions that are elsewhere. You know, so that's like, that's the $90 million solution. Mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful one, but that's not something that can be replicated in a lot of places. But then you go to the other end of the spectrum. There are tiny things that cities can do to support diversity. So one of the things that New York City is doing, for example, is called Green Streets. And Green Streets is effectively what's called a stepping stone program. And so you can build wildlife corridors, which are continuous pathways that animals can use across cities, or you can build stepping stones. Stepping stones are small green spaces that are effectively linked. And so they're called stepping stones. Like you think about stones crossing a river that you can use to hop across. It's the same concept here, where you effectively provide animals with small kind of areas of respite across a city to allow them to move and, you know, migrate internally or pass through without risking death. So the Green Streets program is tiny. Like it takes these, you know, like a 3-foot wide traffic median that is just concrete in Manhattan, takes out the concrete, plants soil, plants pollinator flowers, plants other small plants that can provide shade. And suddenly you've taken a traffic median that is just a bland concrete space, and you've turned it into a place where birds, insects, even small rodents, or even big rodents like New York City rats, can suddenly take a moment and rest on their way between larger green spaces. Another potential stepping stone that has increasingly been implemented in a lot of places are green roofs. So you take the roof of a building, instead of, you know, just having concrete or, you know, metal or whatever, you plant, you put soil down, you put wild, often native plants, and you create a space that bats and birds and, you know, in some cases, insects, other migratory species can sit, wait, you know, be healthy and be safe. And, you know, you start populating your urban space with all of these stepping stones. It doesn't require carving out, you know, like a continuous path through a busy and wealthy human environment. What it just takes is kind of just transforming some of these spaces that, you know, we've almost forgotten. Like, who thinks about a traffic median? But, you know, you start doing that and you can build out pathways for wild animals to move through cities. And the beautiful part about it is the only side effect is that it makes our cities more beautiful places.
Right. There is that aesthetic that is also pleasing to the human along with that. But hopefully most of us innately want to care for the environments around us. And that means other species and what else is occupying those spaces. I am sad to say we have to wrap up here in just a minute because I have a million more questions for you. But when readers take in your book, Our Wild Familiars, what is something that you truly hope that we can all take away and maybe take action or at least ponder after reading the book?
So first of all, thank you so much for having me. It's been awesome. What I learned writing this book is that there is connection available to all of us in cities. You know, like a lot of people, I felt really disconnected from nature, feel like nature is somewhere out there that I don't get to go to. But in the process of writing this book, and I hope in the process of people reading it, you know, you what I've learned, and I think what readers will learn, is that connection is so accessible. Like, it's right there around us. We are surrounded by nature. And not only are we surrounded, but we're participants in urban ecosystems. And so we can't but help be connected to all of these other forms of life that are around us. And that, to me, is a really beautiful feeling, and one that I think readers will get out of the book.
Well, I think so too. And we so appreciate you being part of this Green Earth. It's Dan Werb, who is an epidemiologist and writer, and has just written a new title. It's called Our Wild Familiars: How Animals Are Adapting to Cities and Reshaping the Natural World. Dan, thank you so much for being a part of this Green Earth. And is there a website that people can go to learn more about your writings or you?
Yeah, absolutely. You can go to danwerb.com. And I'm also active on Instagram at instagram.com/danwerb.
Well, wonderful. Well, thank you so much for being a part of this Green Earth today. And hopefully we can have you back. Thanks for listening to This Green Earth. If you have an idea, we'd love to hear from you. Give us your ideas and topics, your storylines. It's thisgreenearth@kpcw.org. You can also find us wherever you listen to your podcast. If you like the show and you learned something new, make sure you leave a review. And we'd appreciate it if you click 5 stars.